Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Liminalist. This is The Liminalist, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way, just for another chap. And then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I read the rest of the material that you sent me, and thanks for that. So I did read all those chapters, and yeah, enjoyed it a lot. So yeah, good. you've obviously you've really done your research on Strieber. It's a pretty remarkable book.
Great. Well, we've read maybe a quarter or less than a quarter of it, and I'm just trying to wind it up now. After a couple of years, like I left it for a couple of years, like I did the Crucial Fiction site, with the PDFs and the imagery and the audios and stuff, and then that went on for a few weeks, 12 weeks or something, and then that was that. Like I kind of left it hanging, like maybe I would do a part two, like a sequel, but I'd already written most of the material for part two, but I just left it. And then recently, sparked by I don't know what, I've returned to it, and now I'm kind of reignited, actually. It's like I was just going to finish it up and get it in shape for Anomalist, but I felt that to do that properly, I actually wanted to bring something new, something in the present, and it kind of one thing led to another anyway. The Edgar Mitchell led to something else, and so it's kind of, yeah, I'm in the thick of it, and even like you're in there now, actually, believe it or not, whether you'll be happy about this or not, but because part of the narrative is I don't know how clear it is in the chapters I sent you, because it comes and goes, but part of the narrative is the first person narrative of what's going on in my life as I'm writing the book, and I was struck by, I mean, I guess that was the original incentive to want to reach out to you, was, although I'd already contacted you about Mitchell, but was reading Dark Intrusions, the parts I read I hadn't read before, so it was the early chapters, but initially I went to it just to check on the book, because you mentioned about Anomalous books not being that nice looking, so I thought, well, I'll look at Dark Intrusions, and then that made me curious to read my section, the stuff I gave you back then, and so I read that, and that was very interesting to me in light of the Crucial Fictions exploration and how I've really radically changed my view of all kind of psychic experiences, including or especially the ones that have a similarity to entities or abductions. I now see them very differently. So I also read my own testimony and remembered my own testimony in a different light. And then I went on to read your own descriptions, and those were very interesting to me. I hadn't, somehow it had passed me by just how autobiographical the book was, which is what I really like in a book, when the author brings his own experiences in there. But also specifically how ample your experiences have been of those phenomena. I didn't realize that.
First of all, I should say that I wrote the book, many years ago, and I'm quite embarrassed by it now, of course. And because it is quite a personal book, and I guess I've been judged on that book. I mean, it did sort of make quite an impression, and really, it's the only book of mine that people really talk about. So,
Really?
you know, I've written two books after that, and yeah, they haven't been noticed at all. But you know, people always seem to focus in on Dark Intrusions, and you know, it was just about a month ago that I was contacted by this British director, and he's working on a quite a sort of like a paranormal thriller film, and so he wanted to you know, he wanted me to read the screenplay and give him some feedback and sort of help him with the paranormal elements of the, because it seems as though that book did inspire him a lot to come up with the story for his screenplay. So
Did you hear anything from that Rodney Asher who just made the film about sleep paralysis?
no, I didn't actually. It's funny because he did contact you know, all these people that I know who've written on, well, he seemed to have contacted pretty much everyone who's written about sleep paralysis
Except you.
except me. Yeah. I think it was yeah, I think maybe he thought it was just a little bit too out there. You know, and the thing is, I kind of have a very different view of those kind of experiences these days anyway. So, but when I wrote the book, I guess I was so immersed in that world that I probably got a little bit carried away. And I'm not saying that I exaggerated my experiences, but you know, I just kind of got well, you know, what happens to Whitley Strieber, I guess, was his, you know, experiences. He sort of, yeah, gets very immersed in that world and sort of can't really view it from a from another perspective and you know, objectively, I suppose. He'd probably disagree with that, but
He might, yeah, he probably would, which would kind of only prove your point in my mind. This is actually what I get into as the Prisoner Infinity continues, particularly in the last two chapters apart. Part one, so where you got to, which is chapter 10, is the extent to which Strieber, as an example, although I bring Lewis Stevenson in there also, because I just found out about this, may be using writing as a way to handle the forces of the unconscious by framing them through, with the mind, by creating a narrative around them, and therefore having some sort of control by having control over the narrative, and how it's this two-way thing. Because Stevenson, it's very interesting. He talked about the brownies. Well, the reason I sent it, mentioned it to you specifically was that he had night terrors as a child, and one of the examples he gives, he writes about in the third person in that chapter I sent you, which I think is quite telling in itself. It's clearly about himself, and he mentions how this child, as a child, had night terrors. And one of the examples he gives was the color brown, how the color brown was terrifying to him, even though during the day, during waking, he had no problem with it. And I mention this because he then goes on to talk about these beings that he feels visit him in the night and give him, as an adult, they give him inspiration and they help him to deal with his financial problems and basically keep the ideas flowing as a writer. So Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was, he says, was basically given to him in his dreams by these entities, and he calls the entities brownies. So he's there indirectly, implicitly correlating these entities with his night terrors as a child. And yeah, I mean, you have to read the piece, but essentially he's giving all credit to these beings, but also kind of implying that he's in some way hostage to them, that they're using him to as a vehicle to, I don't know if he really implies that, that's more Whitley's thing, but it's clear there's a kind of there's an ambivalence in him, because on the one hand he's attributing them to this source of terror, that, the uncontrollable power of his unconscious, and on the other hand he's saying that he can use them to keep his bankers at bay, to pay his bills. And so this is kind of, I think there's something very telling there, and as I say, it seems to correspond with what I've explored around Strieber, which is that he has this same ambivalence, and he seems to be using his writing ability to contain and control and recontextualize his experience, while at the same time he's kind of giving his writing ability to this force that's using him, right? There's this Faustian bargain, you might say.
Do you think that that maybe there are, I mean, Whitley Strieber's theory is that, trauma can kind of, I suppose, open up your third eye and make you experience, enable you to experience these kind of things, entity contact and all that kind of thing. Or do you think it's just mainly his own imagination, creating these experiences? Or do you think it's a little bit of both? Do you think there is actually something there, that there are other
Well,
entities
yeah, I mean
communicating with?
that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And I've tried to various places in this work, like at the beginning, for example, and at certain points throughout, I've tried to make it clear that this isn't an attempt to explain away the experiences, or to yeah, is to fr to frame them as fantasy or imagination. So yeah, it is to do with some kind of overlap, but whether these entities, and maybe you've considered this too, I don't think I saw it in Dark Intrusions, but I didn't read the whole thing, but whether these entities might actually be fragments of us that have been broken away and become somehow autonomous, maybe the collective psyche, and maybe the individual psyche, and maybe both. That seems to be a question that kind of cancels out your question, because we don't actually know what the psyche is, or what it's, how it works. We know so little about the psyche, despite 100 years of psychology, and really we're probably further from really understanding it than in Jung and Freud's day, where it's really been taken seriously, whereas today it doesn't seem to be taken as seriously as it was. So then yeah, what, and if we then factor in trauma, as the psyche can actually be, or figuratively be, fragmented, what does that mean in an actual energetic sense? Like, if the psyche is some sort of energy, if it has some kind of form, non-physical or solid, whatever the hell, who words are not, they're very limited here, but if there is some literal element to the fracturing of the psyche, does this mean that there are portions of an individual or collective psyche that are then, acting as if autonomous, and we might encounter them as actual entities? I think that this is a very real question that isn't getting asked in the field much.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think they're all good points that you made.
So what do you think? I mean, I'm interested to go back to that point that we first got sidetracked from, which was that you feel that the way that you recounted your experiences in Dark Intrusions doesn't necessarily represent how you would see it now.
No.
So, to what extent do these experiences translate into, from the liminal state, in which the mind is not the determinant of reality, is not the filter for reality, it's been removed, or at least reduced, to when the mind reasserts its hold, and then, it's because we're talking about the psychology of the guardian, or the defense system of the ego, that has to interpret every experience in such a way that it keeps its own reality, or its own hegemony on perception, in place. So what I'm getting is a very long-winded way of saying, can we trust our own interpretations of these experiences?
That's a good question. I don't think we can really. I guess I could have easily have become convinced, from my sleep paralysis experiences that I'd been experiencing, alien abduction or something like that.
Yeah.
Certainly we can't really trust our own interpretation of these things.
So you mentioned that in an email, you mentioned that these experiences have mercifully led off, that you're not having them anymore. Is that was that what you were
Yeah,
saying?
not really, no. I mean, every now and then, but I guess my attitude is that I don't really care so much anymore. I just kind of ignore these things. I just don't want to get sucked into that whole world again. And I've just got so many other concerns, I suppose. It's sort of like with sleep paralysis, it tends to affect people who are certain age groups and like people in their late teens, early 20s, etc. And I'm a lot older now, and it just doesn't happen as often. So
Was it a gradual tapering off or
it's
sudden?
sort of more or less, and also your mental and physical health obviously has something to do with it as well. I mean, if you're going through a very difficult, stressful period in life, then you're more likely to have these experiences. And of course your teenage years and early 20s can be a very difficult time for a lot of people, so those kind of psychological states can make these experiences more likely to occur. I wonder too, like reading, because your work, I was just thinking that it's interesting how when Whitley Strieber started having these, well, he said they were just memories of his close encounter experiences, actually happened when he'd just become a father. He had a little boy, and that was a big part of the story as well, particularly in the movie Communion. And I just wonder, because you mentioned in your book about how that can be very psychologically devastating for certain people, being a parent. So I wonder if that kind of opened him up to these experiences, the fact that he'd just become a father.
Well, how close was it? How old was Billy? Is it Billy? No, that was the name of the novel he wrote. What was his son's name?
I can't remember, but I think that's definitely worth looking into. And he doesn't actually mention his son at all these days. I don't know, has he
No, I
just got the
think they
one
had.
child or?
As far as I know, and the impression I've got is that they're estranged now, the father and son.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, but he was, I can't remember his name because he writes about him a lot. He was Andrew. It was Andrew. He was pretty young in communion, but he was old enough to be talking. So I'd say he was at least 4 or 5, would be my guess. So that's quite delayed. But on the other hand, I mean, the thing about that you must have found in Prisoner Infinity, I don't remember putting it in there, and this is a very good point that you're making, because I ought to have more of this in here, is that what I've heard and what seems to be true to me is that if you, although I'm not a parent, so I can't confirm it, but it sounds right, is that when you have a child, because you're connected to that child psychically and, in the DNA at the deepest level, really, unconsciously you're reliving, like at a bodily level, you're remembering your own experiences at those ages, from birth onwards. So when your child is 3, your body, the body memories of you being that age are also being activated, whether or not you're having conscious recall of them. It's stirring in the body. And so what would be very interesting in this regard is what age Whitley was when he was given over to this program, the special school where he was tortured and sexually abused, according to him. How closely that age corresponded with the age that Andrew was when he started having the remembering the visitor experiences.
Yeah, this whole secret
I'd say
program.
pretty
But
close, yeah.
that's kind of a were you impressed with his book Solving the Communion Enigma? Because that's when he really sort of investigated that whole, what he talked about, what you just mentioned, being involved in this program as a child. I don't know, do you feel that he's sort of getting a little bit sort of closer to the truth, I suppose, of these experiences? I mean, the fact that he'd mention all that, and you know, I guess you got to give him a bit of credit. Yeah, just the, you know, the journey he's been on. I guess it's, I kind of feel that maybe his view of this whole thing has evolved, you know, to an extent. And that seems to be really, you know, what the whole alien abduction phenomenon is about. It all kind of comes back to that, yeah, you know, childhood trauma and so on.
Well, yes, I think it does, but that is not what Whitley is communicating. That's not what he's propagating. I mean, his take on it in the Communion Enigma seems to be that, yes, he was taken by these government Nazi-type doctors, and yes, he was tortured and abused,
yeah,
and that the result of that, yes, was the fracturing of his psyche, and although he's never actually admitted to being a multiple, you know, dissociative identity disorder, he shows all the symptoms of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, I guess, well, anyway, maybe eventually he will get to that. But his overriding point about those experiences now is that through them he gained access to the visitors, that he gained access to a higher level of reality, and that therefore it was a good thing that this happened.
Yeah.
And that therefore this could happen to you, or this could happen to more people, that if they were traumatized, then their psyches will be split open to make contact with the other dimensions. And I don't know. I mean, this is, I don't want to oversimplify his position, but in Communion Enigma, he is, and I get to this in the two last chapters of part one of Prisoner of Infinity, that he is advocating trauma as a form of evolutionary engineering. He's saying that's what the visitors are doing.
Hmm.
They're increasing our brain capacity by torturing us, and it's good.
Yeah.
So, and I am oversimplifying there. He certainly wouldn't put it as baldly as that, but you don't have to read between the lines. You just have to read it carefully, what he's saying. And he has an ally in Jeffrey Kripal now. You know, I found out through your website, actually, that they've written this book together.
Yeah.
And Kripal's thing is also about the traumatic secret and how the sacred is accessed through trauma, and essentially how enlightened states and access to the higher dimensions is brought about through trauma one way or another.
Mm.
Whether the experiences themselves are traumatic or whether the trauma allows for the experience to happen, or both, but nonetheless, I find it deeply, deeply suspicious. As do I find the fact that Kripal is legitimizing Strieber at all for an academic figure. I think that's very fishy, I must say.
Yeah, well, I guess they're both very well connected people, and you know, we've got to acknowledge the fact that there's kind of a very big community involved in all this, you know, this area.
Yeah.
You know, they've been sort of jointly researching all this stuff. And, you know, that includes people, you know, obviously in the CIA and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a really massive project. It's been going on for decades.
Yep.
Thank you.
corresponded with Crackle, haven't you? And
yeah.
You don't agree with his position that trauma is necessarily a good thing in the sense that it opens up the mind to these experiences, that it's not really, because I agree with that. It's not really, when I read, about Whitley Strieber's experiences now, I just kind of, I guess he just sort of comes across as a very troubled individual. And
he certainly does, yeah.
I think he probably would have been a lot better off if he hadn't been exposed to all that as a child. And I don't know if he'd be a writer these days. That's hard to say.
If you listen to how he was in interviews at the time of Communion and how he is now, I just listened to him on Art Bell from 2014, and it was quite disturbing how kind of histrionic he is, and compared to how he was just when these memories were surfacing and he'd just written Communion. He just sounds very balanced and very credible and very considered and thoughtful and like a completely different person, and it doesn't speak well. And I mean, this is kind of, for me, that's the irrefutable evidence that whatever Strieber is describing is not a benevolent thing, or it's not he hasn't benefited from it despite all of his insistences to the contrary. And but that, of course, as evidence is kind of inadmissible, because it seems like ad hominem attack, like a personal slight, even though I think it's painfully obvious to anyone who listens to Strieber that he's very unbalanced. But I feel bad even saying that, if I was going to put it on the air, because it seems mean to say it, and it seems like a subjective thing. But I don't think it is subjective. I really don't. I don't think anyone could listen to Whitley now and back after Communion and not agree that he really sounds a lot worse, a lot less credible now than he did back then.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, as I was reading your book, I guess I felt a sort of profound sadness, really, when I was reading that, about Whitley's experiences and disjointed memories and all that kind of thing. He's had one hell of a journey. It's really, I don't know. So I guess amazing that he managed to hold it together so well.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad that you feel sadness when you read the book, because I think that if it didn't have that, it wouldn't be.
You certainly show sympathy towards Strieber.
I'm very sympathetic to him. I'm very compassionate, and I feel a lot of affinity. You're saying it's amazing he's held it together as well as he has, and yes, in a sense, I'm getting a picture of the Frankenstein monster now, that he's been stitched together. And I think, this is a major premise of Prisoner Infinity, is that the possibility that Strieber, as an example, just one example, that all the things that happened to him from childhood onward were a way to, can't think of the verb, engineer is rather an easy verb, but to bring about the very circumstances that have come about, to turn him into this writer, to create this public spokesperson who would propagate specific set means and beliefs and philosophies and ideas. And that he was engineered. He was like, just like Frankenstein's monster in a sense, but at a psychological level. He was engineered as a vehicle for certain ideas, part of this larger agenda that you were talking about, which eventually we can get into, but this is obviously a much larger topic. But my point here is that as far as having compassion for Strieber, that I feel that also has to be balanced out with an awareness that he is serving agendas that really are pretty dark, pretty reprehensible, I think. I mean, it's painful to say it because I do feel sympathy for him, but more and more I'm just having to look at the evidence, and it's just so... compelling. I was going to say sickening, but I don't want to. I just feel like we're being unfair or something. But I really do. I mean, like, I was just talking about Kripal. He's the, he's a part of the Noetic Institute, Noetic Sciences, Mitchell's thing. You're saying it's quite a large
Community, yep.
community, but actually, it's not. It's actually quite small, but it's just very, very far-reaching. But the same players and the same suspects arise, and the same themes, the same memes, the same ideas, the same philosophies, and more and more, I'm seeing that the whole alien abduction thing, although I don't believe it's completely fabricated at all, but that the narrative that's been created around it through popular entertain, fiction and non-fiction, UFO studies, and Strieber being the, the main, the head cornerstone, if you will, of alien abduction lore, is all part of a larger propaganda agenda, like pertaining specifically to space travel, and the idea of space travel, and getting people behind the idea of space travel, but not exclusively. I mean, that's like the biggest, I think that's the biggest sort of multinational agenda that I'm finding more and more is connected, obviously Edgar Mitchell being, exhibit A there, because
Brian
he's
O'Leary.
propagating both. Well, I haven't looked into Brian O'Leary, but I must do that. But Mitchell is very interesting because I also found a website of his just yesterday called experience.co. It's not his website, but he's part of it. Did you know about this company or whatever?
Yeah, I did hear about that. They wanted people to come forward and talk to them about their sort of alien abduction experiences. Yeah, it was
Right.
Quite a few high-profile people were involved in that, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Right. So Mitchell is, I mean, he's an astronaut, claims to have walked on the moon, possibly a Freemason, but that's kind of a side issue. Who is, he's been pushing, he did psychic research in the 70s, so he's big
Yeah.
and, heavily involved in that with Puthoff and all those,
You helped
Puharik and all
bring
those
Yuri Geller
guys.
to the United States to be studied.
Right, there you go. So they've got the psychic research angle. Then you've got this overview effect. He's part of the Overview Institute, which is saying that if we go into space and see the Earth from space, what happened to Mitchell will happen to us. We will discover oneness. We will discover the reality of God. So it's this spiritual, there's a spiritual evolutionary consequence of, going into space. And then, so that links to the human potential. And then, of course, the fact that he's now also propagating extraterrestrial contact and, doing a John Mack with drawing in abductees and helping them to remember their experiences in the right way. I don't know if he's actually involved in talking to people, but it's that whole organization is clearly a Mackean kind of thing for abductees to be helped, quote unquote, I would say steered towards adopting the correct narrative.
Do you think so? Do you think they have a whole sort of that this is kind of like a religion for them, or a whole philosophy that they've constructed, or?
I think it's totally cynical. I think it's just a way to forward the agendas that need to be forwarded, which have to do with extending, expanding into space. I mean, I think they're conquering inner space too, so I don't want to just reduce it to one thing, but so inner and outer, whatever the equivalent is of of conquering outer space. But I don't, and I think that turning it into a religion has been on the books from at least from the 70s. I mean, there's documentation. I've just been reading it just before talking to you. A NASA report about it's called scenario planning. So they create fictional narratives about the future around space travel, space colonization, as a way to try it out. And part of that is to do with indoctrinating the public so that they will want to go into space. And of course, there's many different ways you can do that. 2001 is Exhibit A. Again, I mean, that artifact has the whole thing really in miniature, as in if we go into space, even if we've we're doing it in a militaristic fashion, we will become gods. That's the message of 2001. But also, if you think alien abduction, just I mean, alien abductees, they come away from their experiences with this feeling of affinity with the stars, right? The passport to the cosmos, as John Mack put it, but also they're awakening their psychic potential. So the both inner and outer space are kind of opened up to them, and it does, I mean, it just generally it creates the impression that space is this amazing place, as opposed to, well, a very cold, empty, dark place, where normally rational people wouldn't want to go to live a better life, you know.
I mean, I kind of, I've seen a lot of science fiction movies and read a lot of science fiction books, and I guess I do. I find the idea of traveling in a spaceship to some, distant planet or whatever quite kind of exciting, I suppose.
Sure.
But at the same time,
But the reality would be sitting around for years on
exactly.
end with a bunch of people and
Getting sort of well, kind of cabin fever, I suppose.
yeah. And then a lot of work when you got there, presumably.
It probably would be pretty bleak, really. And
Yeah.
I guess too, we've got a responsibility to look after the planet and so on too. And it seems to be it's almost as though they think that the planet's totally screwed. And, we've already destroyed the environment, and it's just a matter of time before there's some big cataclysm and it's going to wipe us out. So we've got to very quickly get off the planet and colonize other worlds, kind of thing. So I don't really agree with that. I think really we've our responsibility is to stay here and kind of look after the place, but also I just wanted to say, with the whole UFO phenomenon, because I've been looking into this a lot lately, plasmas, that includes ball lightning and things like that. It sounds as though a lot of these UFO experiences actually involve, these plasmas. Perhaps when you encounter these objects, it could, it could put you into a kind of altered state of consciousness, a sort of trance state or something. I mean, this is something that Whitley Strieber has been investigating. But, I think there is something really kind of genuine at the core of these experiences. Maybe it's been kind of manipulated along a certain path. But, I think that's where we need to kind of focus our energies is, looking at, ball lightning and things like that, because, some of them seem to exhibit a sort of kind of, basic kind of intelligence. So they could be these, they could be entities of some kind of form of life that exists on this planet that sort of manifests, during thunderstorms and things like that. Also, like geological activity, you have earthlights, for example.
Right.
It's just interesting how, like, the UFO phenomenon, people are so focused on, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I don't know why
Yeah,
that is.
it is
And
interesting. Well, it has to do with, I think, doesn't it have to do with the fact that we've been scientifically trained to believe that there's nothing new under the sun and that all the mysteries of the earth have been explained. So lightning is just lightning, you know, wind is just wind. It's the disenchantment of the world, like there's, you know, the anti-animistic view that everything is just object. And so, but the human psyche needs that sense of mystery, and it knows, we at a deep level we know that life is a mystery. So then where does that need, it has to latch on to something. So then, and then, so then something weird and inexplicable happens. There's this, maybe it's an assumption, or maybe it is just being subtly and covertly seeded in us that we will interpret it that way, or maybe it's both, but that we will then interpret, no, well, that's not ball lightning. It's kind of the joke that people, you know, you call UFO swamp gas, ha ha ha. Actually, you know, maybe they are swamp gas, and maybe swamp gas is far more mysterious and fantastic than an extraterrestrial craft, you know. Like the mysteries of the earth and the mysteries of the human body are are unfathomed, you know, they're unexplored.
Mm.
And yet we're saying, oh, it's all used up and it's in, we've got to go into space. And
Yeah.
so that seems symptomatic, doesn't it, of something like the sort of kind of pathology? Because if we got to space, or if the alien landed and walked around, we'd get bored of that. We'd just say, oh, we turn everything into, you know, familiar. We, as soon as we get familiar with something, we're not interested. We want that feeling of novelty.
Exactly. That's why, so many marriages fail, for example. I mean, if we can't even solve those kind of problems, then maybe we're not quite ready to start reaching out into space, you know? Yeah, well, I'm not really working on any major projects myself. I've sort of, I guess I've, oh, I don't know, I kind of write the old book review and things like that, but not really writing anything on, psychic phenomena or UFOs or anything like that.
Let's talk about that, because you said that Dark Intrusions was made more of an impact than your other two books, and also you've said, which is interesting, and also you've said that after the electromagnetic book, that you don't want to write any more esoteric nonfiction. So do you want to talk about that a bit? I'm definitely curious about where you're at with that whole process.
Yeah, well, I guess my book Strange Electromagnetic Dimensions was it's mainly a science book, and I guess I wanted to, it was my attempt to kind of start from the ground up, I suppose, and just kind of, sort of look at what we know and then kind of take it from there. Like, with Dark Intrusions, it was kind of more like the opposite approach. I just got sort of caught up with all these kind of quite eccentric ideas. I guess with Strange Electromagnetic Dimensions, it was kind of like, let's look at how, let's look at things like ball lightning and how, electric shock can affect the body, and the whole thing about lightning shamans and things like that. Electric people, and also how the body uses electricity to function, and how artificial electromagnetic fields impact on the body and things like that. So I thought that was, it hadn't really been done before, I suppose, in other books, and so yeah, that's what the book's about. But yeah, I didn't really receive, much of a response from that. And I guess really what people want is, they they want the sort of Dark Intrusions type material, spirits and aliens and all that kind of thing. I guess because that's more appealing. It's got more entertainment value, I suppose. So I just found it very interesting that, some of these people I'd been in contact with, suddenly, sort of didn't really want to know me at all.
Yeah, well, is this possible that a number of these UFO riders are actually working for somebody and that they have to stay on track, that they're not actually genuinely researching, and they're not genuinely curious, or even if they are, the sort of in between thing, they have a narrative and they're attached to the narrative and invested in it, whether or not they're being paid, as operatives, and so anything that's outside of that narrative that doesn't reinforce it just doesn't get their attention.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. That kind of makes you think, there's really no point kind of researching and writing about this subject because whatever I publish, whatever I write, it's not going to be, it's not going to receive any attention and therefore, not going to sell any books. And, I guess there's no point, really.
What about the Moon Book? How did that do?
The Moon Book? I think I sort of pissed off a lot of people who were quite invested in the whole, the idea that there were already aliens on the moon, because I was saying, I don't see any evidence of that. And also, people who subscribe to the spaceship moon theory. I was saying that there is some evidence that the moon has been possibly artificially hollowed out, but I don't think it's actually a giant spaceship as such. So people weren't really, I got some positive feedback for the book, but I don't know. I found that a lot of these, like for many decades, particularly, during, when the, during the, throughout the Apollo program and so on and afterwards, quite a few UFO researchers were, they were writing about, there being evidence of aliens on the moon, structures and things like that. And of course, that sort of ties into the whole Richard Hoagland kind of material, looking at these NASA photographs and saying, oh, that looks like I can see a building there or whatever. I was kind of saying that a lot of that sort of seems to be nonsense, really.
Including the Hoagland?
I'm a little bit sort of suspicious of some of his research, I suppose.
That's good.
Yeah, so, of course, when I was on, I was on a couple of these programs, talking about the book, and the interviewers sort of really wanted me to, basically to say that there are aliens on the moon, and NASA's been covering the whole thing up, and also ancient structures on the moon, and I wasn't really sort of willing to go there. As I said, I'm a little bit kind of skeptical about all that, so. So, yeah.
So did you feel pressure then?
Oh, pressured.
In that regard, to say things that you didn't believe?
Yeah, well, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, as I said, there doesn't seem to be much point sort of writing about these things, because if you're not sort of...
on message...
Yeah, if you've got a different idea about these things, then you're not going to get a very positive response or really much of a response
at all.
Well, that's
in a particular community, though, isn't it, that we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly, but they're kind of the ones who run the show, they manage all this information, don't they, obviously if they like what you're writing and, then they'll tell their... associates or whatever, and then, before you know it, your book's a success. It gets promoted.
Look in the sky, see what comes up ahead. Further and you'll see the back of your own head. Measure the circle, begin where you like. Statistics discuss, Wednesday's the spike.
Yeah, but you have had, more of that than I've had in a much shorter time. I mean, you've had several endorsements from quite mainstream. So Colin Wilson, Dean Radin, Whitley Strieber. There's one more who's quite a big shot, at least. Yeah, I mentioned this to you in an email that my sense of you, of what was going on with you, was that you were being groomed. That you were being considered as a potential spokesperson for the community or in the community. I don't think when we're talking about the community here, we shouldn't get confused the terms, because I initially, just a moment ago, I was talking about the alternate perceptions community, i.e. the researchers and the people who read their stuff or follow their stuff. So that's the community that recognizes itself as a community that's very loose, it's informal. I think you thought I was talking about the deeper community, as in the intelligence agencies and who are actually running the show behind the scenes, maybe. Yeah. I would say they are. I don't know where you're at on that. I'm not entirely 100%, but I feel that probably most of the main radio shows and publishers and whatnot are probably run by intelligence agencies, my feeling. So that, if you're talking about the intelligence community, that's one thing. Talking about the alternate perceptions community, that's the other. But so my feeling was that you were being, at whatever level, you were being considered as maybe a viable or a useful spokesperson who would be able to be useful, who would be useful to disseminate the ideas. And that was, Dark Intrusions. Then the Moon one, seems like you did get endorsements for that. And it seems like there's still some, you're still being considered up to your last book as far as being useful. I don't want to oversimplify and just sound paranoid, but I have to, because it takes too long to say anything otherwise. You said this also with the anomalous thing, that you wouldn't cooperate in certain ways, and part of it has to do with you don't like doing interviews, I know, but if it also has to do with, and that obviously that would be significant in itself, but it also has to do with that you won't say the things that you're supposed to be saying, and you're not writing about the things that you're supposed to be writing about, then I guess you would become less and less useful. Within that context, and that's the context that you've chosen, as have I to some extent, because it seems like, where else can we explore these ideas, right? But I think there are other options.
Well, I guess the whole thing, the whole area just seems, it seems pretty murky to me now, I guess what I was aiming for was some sort of clarity, I suppose, but it just seems murkier and murkier.
You mean your own understanding of the subjects that you're exploring?
Not just my own understanding, but just all the ideas that are out there, and all the agendas that are going on, and so on. The intelligence community involvement, and I don't know. I just there's very little there that is really going to inspire, you know, a writer to want to sort of keep going, I suppose, you know. Yeah, it seems almost kind of futile, I suppose.
A writer like yourself.
Yeah, you mean. Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because there are plenty of writers.
Yeah, no, that's...
Whitley, of course, or Hancock, who you have a photo of with on your blog, who seem to have a ball, you know, just disseminating the right information, and they have bestsellers, but it seems to me that they are not writers in the sense that you and I are writers.
Mm.
As in genuinely trying to explore a mystery and... there does seem to be a difference here, like a qualitative difference that, it may not be as simple as they've been, co-opted, but also what the intention is by writing. If, you know, you want to just come up with a really good story that will sell, and as non-fiction, or you actually really want to keep digging and, you know, not be too concerned about the actual narrative that you're creating. I've been thinking about this also with Prisoner of Infinity, which really is, it's so relevant to the community that it's not as though it wouldn't interest people. It's just that it would, well, just the fact that it really is undermining or pulling the rug out from all of these lovely, wonderful dissociative narratives is you know, going to make it unappetizing.
Yeah.
Of course. So that was a preamble, but do I want to be going on these cheesy alternate perception shows, which, as you experience to your, you know, chagrin, they just want the latest spicy, sexy narrative about aliens on the moon? So even if they did let me have their say, the context in which it's said is, you know, indispensable, is essential, is inseparable from what's being said.
Yeah.
As well as which, I mean, add to that the fact that I would be legitimizing these venues, which probably are intelligence infiltrated, if not created, but just by being on them.
Mm.
So do I really want to participate in this community at all? I think the answer I'm reaching is no.
Yeah.
I don't want to, except to expose it, but there's no point, you know, exposing it to itself. That's just silly. You just end up, you know, like Frankenstein getting chased by torch-wielding villagers. There's no positive outcome from that. Nobody's going to thank me, right?
No.
For coming in there and saying this building is unsound, it has to be destroyed.
Now, here's what happened to me, and when it happened, I was just exactly where most people are to this day. I would have scoffed at anybody who talked about Close Encounters of the Third Kind as anything except fiction.
Very well, thank you.
At Area 51, do you? And Mr. Weaver, I've got a question.
Whitley Weaver.
Listen, I'm very hard to talk to if you can't even pronounce my name.
I'm sorry.
Well, try it. Say Streaver, and I'll answer.
Streaver.
You can't even, you don't want to say it. So what's your question? Underneath the bed is a loaded Benelli riot gun. In the bedside table is a little pistol, an AMT backup. A difficult pistol to use, but I do know how to use it. And
I'm with you all the way. I'd have guns too.
Yeah, well, exactly. So I'm good with this pistol. I know both of my weapons, and I know how to use them. And I'm willing.